Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at MathWorks.com. Support for this podcast comes from the Fletcher School of Global Affairs at Tufts University. To start your future as a global changemaker, you must have context across fields like international business, cybersecurity, energy policy, and more. Don't just study global affairs, shape them. Visit fletcher.tufts.edu.
From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Anthony Lewis is one of America's most eminent journalists. For half a century, the two-time Pulitzer Prize-winning reporter and columnist has covered the biggest events and trends in American and world history, writing eloquently about the Vietnam War, Watergate, the Iraq War, and above all, issues of justice and the law. Near the end of 2001, he retired from the New York Times, but he is still watching, worrying, and writing about terror, torture, civil liberties, and responsibility up the American chain of command, all the way up to the Oval Office. Tonight on Point, Anthony Lewis on the use and abuse of executive power in America from Watergate to Guantanamo. But first, we begin tonight in Washington, where today the chairman of the Securities and Exchange Commission, William Donaldson, announced he will resign at the end of the month after 2.5 high-pressure years at the SEC helm. Here's Donaldson announcing his resignation just a few hours ago.
Any disagreements that we may have had on the commission or elsewhere out there in the world have had nothing to do with my decision to resign.
The embattled SEC head has been criticized from all sides, from business groups who say he's been too tough on corporations, to investor activists who say he's been too soft, to Republicans on the commission resisting business regulation. Joining me now is Jim McTagg, Washington Bureau Chief for Barron's Magazine. Jim, thanks for being with us. Why is Donaldson going away?
Well, you know, this is not a surprise. He's been under pressure from the White House because he voted too often with the Democrats on the commission. There were two Democrats and two Republicans, and he sided often with the Democrats.
What has he voted for that the White House doesn't like?
Well, I think the big thing he voted for that the White House didn't like was regulation of hedge fund managers. I'm in an airport, by the way. I hope the noise doesn't disturb.
I think you're at O'Hare in Chicago. That's fine, Jim.
Yeah, the managers, you know, hedge funds are the last unregulated financial vehicle in the world. It's a place where rich people, you know, can risk their money and without the government checking every line and, you know, making sure every I is dotted. Chairman Greenspan is a big fan of hedge funds. And when Donaldson voted to have the managers of hedge funds file reports with the Securities and Exchange Commission, it was viewed as the camel getting its nose under the tent. That was very unpopular with the Republicans, and in fact, they started pushing for a replacement for Donaldson. That was back in the early spring. I heard that a White House lawyer was in the running to replace him.
And today he's gone, or announcing that he'll be gone, which will change the voting pattern of that panel. Remind us who William Donaldson is. This is hardly a Democrat Party lefty who came into this position.
No, this is an intellectual heavyweight. William Donaldson once was chairman of the New York Stock Exchange. He was one of the founders of Yale School of Management and actually was dean of that school for quite a while. He founded a brokerage firm, which has been merged out of existence, but it's famous, Donaldson, Lufkin, and Jenrette.
Yep, big name.
So this is a man that knows finance. He's a man that has achieved great things. He's only 73 years old, so, you know, he has many years to go, more achievements ahead.
He came in after the bursting of the 90s bubble, after the Enron meltdown. He came in with enormous challenges sitting in front of him for the SEC. What attitude did he bring to that challenge, Jim?
Well, he's very much his own man. I know people who are friends with Donaldson tell me that he keeps his own counsel, he votes his conscience, and so that's why many of the positions he took were unpopular with the Republicans, but he took them nonetheless.
And how did he explain that to his old Republican friends? Why was he so intent on voting for tougher laws, even when there was resistance from his crowd?
Because he thought it was right. So, for example, he applied tougher rules to the mutual funds. He made their boards more independent after Elliot Spitzer embarrassed the Securities and Exchange Commission and uncovered a scandal right under their noses. And that was when the mutual funds were allowing some hedge funds to trade after hours and get an advantage that people like you and I cannot get. Donaldson came down hard, and he was so loathed by the mutual fund industry that when they held their annual meeting this year, they didn't invite him to speak, and I think that's the first time in modern memory that the head of the SEC was not invited to address that trade group.
It's incredible. Jim, between the Supreme Court ruling this week that overturned the big case against Arthur Andersen for what had been seen as their misdeeds in the Enron case, now we've got William Donaldson, who was a very tough, unstinting eye on corruption and in the business world. How do you add this up? Is the big drive to clean up American business that was launched after the Enron scandal, after all the scandals that came out after the 90s, is it being wound up now? Is it being turned back?
I think the pendulum is swinging the other way. How far it will go remains to be seen. I mean, some of the prosecutors were a little too zealous, and maybe the hammer fell a little too heavily. But, you know, there are cycles in Washington, and I believe that we're going to see the beginning of the rules heading in the opposite direction, a lightening of the regulatory load.
That is back in favor of business. That, given the scale of what happened before, that didn't take long. Jim McTagg, thanks very much for being with us tonight.
Thank you.
Jim McTagg, Washington Bureau Chief for Barron's Magazine. He spoke with us there from O'Hare Airport in Chicago. The issue of executive power is in the air this week. From Watergate's deep throat in the Nixon era to a scathing Amnesty International report on American actions in the war on terror. The report called the American Detention Center at Guantanamo the gulag of our times, a claim that drew some strong words from President Bush.
I'm aware of the Amnesty International report, and it's absurd. It's an absurd allegation.
And today, the gulag charge provoked Defense Secretary Donald Rumsfeld.
No force in the world has done more to liberate people that they have never met than the men and women of the United States military. Indeed, that's why the recent allegation that the U.S. military is running a gulag at Guantanamo Bay is so reprehensible.
Reprehensible. Two-time Pulitzer Prize winner Anthony Lewis covered Watergate, the Supreme Court, the Civil Rights Movement, and more in nearly a half century with the New York Times. Now he's looking closely at the Bush administration, at what he sees as executive overreach and command responsibility that has, he says, gone AWOL. This hour, On Point, a conversation with Anthony Lewis on the use and abuse of executive power in America. You can join the conversation. Is there a thread that runs from Watergate to Abu Ghraib and Guantanamo? Do you want your wartime president large and in charge? Or has executive power post-9/11 been taken too far? You can join us tonight at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Joining me now in the studio is Anthony Lewis, former reporter and columnist for the New York Times. He's a two-time Pulitzer Prize winner. In 2001, he retired his column in the New York Times. He now contributes frequently to the New York Review of Books. We're delighted to have him with us tonight. Anthony Lewis, thanks for being here.
Glad to be here, Tom.
So here we are. What a time. What a week. Ghosts of Watergate on the loose again just in the last 24 hours, as you've been raising all kind of alarms about the post-9/11 era. But the first question I put to listeners, let me put it straight to you, Anthony Lewis. Is there a thread that connects abuses of executive power across generations, across wars, from Watergate to Guantanamo? Are there constant themes here?
There is the theme of abuse of executive power, which is what Watergate was about. President Nixon's desire to duck accountability, to investigate the tax returns of his enemies, to raid Dan Ellsberg's psychiatrist's office, and many lawless things, all undercover and without congressional authorization, executive power misused. But I have to say that abusive though that seemed at the time, and still does, it doesn't seem to me to equal the mistreatment and indeed the murder, let's not forget, the government has admitted 28, I think, prisoners of ours in the Middle East have been murdered.
That have died in American custody.
Died in American custody in what was what were officially termed homicides. Maybe I misused the word murder. Let's stick with homicide. Pretty bad. And That seems to me to be really deadly.
But do you draw a line from those deaths, homicide, murder, call it what you will, to the executive, to the White House? Are these examples of an abuse of executive power, or as Donald Rumsfeld has said repeatedly, no, these are incidents that happen far from the center of power. This is not my command responsibility, nor is it the president's. It's these folks run amok.
Well, just remember that the counsel to President Bush, Alberto Gonzalez, who now is Attorney General, signed off on memos that it attempted to really explain away the law and treaty against torture by Americans. Said that torture, that nothing was torture unless it was equivalent to organ failure or even death, set a very high level for torture, and said the Geneva Conventions, which bar mistreatment of war prisoners, didn't apply to large numbers of people. And you can't get any closer to the top than that. That was the Justice
President's
Department
Attorney General
officials and Alberto Gonzalez signing off.
You've called almost a year ago for an independent prosecutor armed with subpoena power to bring a criminal investigation in these cases. Ralph Nader, who talks big and often, is now calling for impeachment of President Bush. What's the right course forward?
Well, I'm bound to react to Ralph Nader's comment with a certain cynicism, and we wouldn't have President Bush if Ralph Nader had gotten out of the way in the year 2000, as every rational person was urging him to do. But I'm glad you remembered my calling for a special counsel investigation, because I still think that was the right thing to do. What we've had now is a determined effort by President Bush and Rumsfeld and the others around at the top to brush everything under the rug, to pretend that it only was a few misguided soldiers, you know. But whatever happened to the chain of command, to the idea of command responsibility, which is deep in American military tradition?
Tony Lewis, hold the thought. We're digging in deep tonight with Anthony Lewis, looking at the use and abuse of executive power in America. You can join us. What is Watergate's ultimate lesson about the U.S. presidency, about American checks and balances? And what about now? 1-800-423-8255. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight with longtime Pulitzer Prize-winning New York Times reporter and columnist Anthony Lewis about the use and abuse of executive power in America, from Watergate to Guantanamo. You can join the conversation tonight. What do you think? What about the exercise of executive power in the war on terror? Has it defended the nation? Has it gone too far? And was Amnesty International right to call Guantanamo the gulag of our time? Or was that, as President Bush put it, absurd, as Donald Rumsfeld said, reprehensible? You can join us at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Anthony Lewis, I want to come in some depth to this issue of command responsibility, but I want to linger just for another moment, if we may, on Watergate. You were reporting from Washington at that time. You were reporting on the events around the Watergate scandal. Now we have Deep Throat who's out, and you say all of that overshadowed by what's going on now. Yet here's the kind of anonymous source who made so much possible in those days, coming forward. What does it leave you thinking from the perspective of 2005 about Nixon, Watergate, that hinge point in American history?
Well, it reminds you that we depend on some very fragile things. We depend on a man like Mark Felt coming forward and talking to Bob Woodward and Carl Bernstein and starting the toboggan that led eventually to Nixon's resignation and saved us from some pretty serious things. We depend on the soldiers who took photographs of what went on in the Abu Ghraib prison in Iraq, photographs which, when published, made it impossible to deny that some terrible things were taking place under American responsibility. And whistleblowers, on a very grand scale, we might say, they were very large whistleblowers, and our system depends on that. We have to have some people willing to speak truth to power.
And what about the vigor of that system, those antibodies today?
I think it's good, but I think the vigor is strong, but it's being resisted mightily. Every effort to keep everything secret and very severe penalties for anybody who speaks out. Members of the military who have objected to mistreatment of prisoners have found themselves transferred, subordinated, not given advancement, and so on. It's very tough because the secrecy blanket is the toughest it's ever been in Washington, in my opinion, and many opinions.
The war on terror, as you've written, is hardly the first war in which the American executive, the White House, and its minions have taken on extraordinary powers. Is this just part and parcel of the way America goes to war? Was it ever thus? Is it necessary, even? Is it from another angle, part of how the country defends itself? Or has it always been, is it this time necessarily a failing, a threat, a danger?
There have been repeated instances in American history of presidents arrogating great powers to themselves in time of war. The recent example that always comes to mind is President Roosevelt sequestering 100,000 Japanese Americans, taking them from their homes on the West Coast and putting them in desert camps. But I don't know of any other occasion in which Americans have engaged in widespread torture and even killing of prisoners of war. That's so indecent and so against all international efforts to make war prisoners relatively safe. I want to tell you a story.
Please.
I was talking about this the other night with an old friend of mine, and he suddenly said, and I was talking about the effort of the Bush administration to exclude the Geneva Conventions on the treatment of prisoners to narrow them down and exclude them. And he suddenly looked rather quizzical, and he said, "I love the Geneva Conventions." I said, "What do you mean?" He said, "You forget, I was a prisoner of war in World War II. I was a German prisoner, and I really was grateful for the Geneva Conventions. We've benefited from those through a long history."
Because they've protected prisoners from abuse.
Protected us,
American
soldiers, from abuse when they were taken prisoner. And, of course, it's a reciprocal thing. And the notion, and it was resisted by Secretary of State Colin Powell for that very reason. He objected to these memos that were written by the Justice Department lawyers and approved by Alberto Gonzalez and Bush because he said, "What's going to happen to our people? We want those conventions."
But when you talk about command responsibility, when you call for a special prosecutor, for a criminal investigation, that implicit in what you're saying, an investigation that goes right to the top, right to the Oval Office, you're talking about responsibility that should, in your view, end up there in the Oval Office. I'm looking here at a recent essay by James Schlesinger, former Secretary of Defense. And, of course, he executed one of the investigations that the Department of Defense asked for about abuse of prisoners. He says, and I just wonder if he may have you among others in mind here, he says, "Having hyped it from the beginning, the media developed a vested interest in the theory that the misdeeds at Abu Ghraib reflected government policy. That," he says, "is not so. And so the link, the sort of command responsibility assertion, doesn't apply here." He's seconding the notion that this was bad apples in the field. Why are you and others, Tony Lewis, trying to hang it around the neck of President Bush?
Well, first of all, before we get to President Bush, I'm trying to pin the responsibility where American military tradition has always had it, on the officers. Command responsibility means that the captain and the major and the general have responsibility for what they see below them or should have seen. That's the rule.
Is that law or is that simply tradition?
No, it's tradition and it's built into the American military system. It's basic for every officer. And to destroy that seems to me to be very dangerous. And when the government actually paves the way for that by adopting legal standards which attempt to minimize the impact of torture. Let me say I was very disappointed in Jim Schlesinger's piece because I have a lot of respect for him, but I think he was trying to explain away something that's very unpleasant to realize. Let me just read you one thing from it. You know, we're not just making this stuff up about Guantanamo. Secretary Rumsfeld says it's reprehensible of Amnesty to say the prisoners at Guantanamo have been mistreated. Here's an FBI agent who was in Guantanamo and observed interrogations and who was horrified, and there were many of them in that category. Quote, "I found a detainee chained hand and foot in a fetal position to the floor with no food or water. Most times they had urinated or defecated on themselves and had been left there 18, 24 hours or more." Is that the American system? Is that what we want America to stand for? That was at Guantanamo and seen not claimed by a prisoner, but seen by FBI agents, a number of them reporting similar things. That just seems to me to be awful.
I've got to press you further on this point because James Schlesinger, he was Secretary of Defense. He says no. He says to this view that you're propounding here, Tony Lewis, he says no. If you treat command responsibility in that way, he says, Eisenhower would have been fired after the Kasserine Pass. MacArthur would have been cashiered for allowing his B-17s to be destroyed at Pearl Harbor. Patton would never have been restored to command. By suggestion, George Bush, Donald Rumsfeld have done what they must in the War on Terror. You would tear down our great military commanders and leave them unable to do the necessary.
Well, the question is whether they're great.
Eisenhower, MacArthur?
Oh, well, no, Eisenhower. MacArthur, you know, turned out to have a few little flaws, like getting us into an unwinnable war with China.
In Korea.
In Korea. Eisenhower made mistakes. Mistakes are a different thing from allowing absolutely inhumane and outrageous and lawless things to go on in your command. That's a different matter.
So what's the case? You know the law well, you know the Constitution, you know the tradition. What's the case that you would make tonight against, I don't know, how high would you make it, Donald, the criminal case? You're calling for a criminal prosecution.
No, I'm calling for a criminal investigation, not for a prosecution. Prosecutions depend on evidence, and I don't have the kind of evidence that would lead me to be a prosecutor. That's another matter.
But you're okay then. You're calling for an independent prosecutor and a criminal investigation.
Yes.
Where would you aim it?
The reason for that is that only an independent criminal prosecutor can have subpoena power. Otherwise, it could also be an investigating commission like the 9/11 commission. But I think this uniquely calls for the strength, and Archibald Cox, let's say, key figure in the investigation of Watergate, whose subpoenaing of the White House tapes led in due course to the resignation of Richard Nixon.
So not just the subpoena power, but the ethical commitment, your words, to go after it. Where would you target this empowered independent prosecutor?
I would begin asking some of the people involved in the torture and mistreatment, some of whose names are known and some of whom have said I was doing what I thought my higher-ups wanted me to do. Several have said that. I would begin going at it from the bottom the way a prosecutor always does. Mm. Try to work it up the chain, whether it's a civilian chain or a criminal chain. But the notion that all these things have gone on, that dozens of people have been killed, prisoners. Here's another thing we haven't mentioned yet. Mm. You know, hundreds of prisoners have been sent by the CIA, which is even less controlled than the military, to other countries like Uzbekistan that routinely practice torture.
The so-called rendering.
Rendition. Mm-hmm. Extraordinary rendition. Mm. So we send them to these other countries, which with tongue-in-cheek say, oh, we're not going to torture them. Well, we just like to have them here for, wallpaper. Mm. That's another thing that's out of control. We haven't yet come to the domestic side, and I have some things to say about that.
We'll come to it. But are you saying that in the absence of a kind of the threat of criminal prosecution, I mean, there have been lots of investigations of these questions. Many government panels have been pulled together to look into these. They've all come back, more or less, with a cleanish bill of health for the higher-ups. Are you saying that without subpoena power and the threat of criminal prosecution, Americans cannot really know the truth about what's gone on?
I think without subpoena power and a genuinely independent prosecutor, somebody with the kind of public respect that Archibald Cox had, the investigations you're talking about were all within the system, within the military.
Commissioned by the Department of Defense, by and large.
Yeah, commissioned by the Department of Defense, and the chances that it was going to bring in charges or criticism of generals were very slim.
There's been... talk that there will, one way, sooner or later, somehow there's going to be a prosecution, whether an American prosecution or an international prosecution of, let's say, Donald Rumsfeld. Do you merit that? I mean, does the situation merit that? Do you buy that? Do you see this as inevitable?
No, I don't see that as inevitable yet. I think we're in the phase of trying to understand what happened. I don't think there can be an international inquiry. It would be resisted, and rightly so. It's our responsibility. It's the American responsibility. We've done it. There are prisoners. We ought to find out what's happening. And, something we haven't talked about yet, this all really depends in the end on public opinion. And the thing that's most discouraging to me in all this is that my fellow Americans the citizens of this country don't seem very exercised about it. They either say, well, the end justifies the means. These may be terrorists. They probably are terrorists, although, in fact, a lot of them are not. They were just picked up in sweeps of civilians. So anything that they want to do to them is fine. Or they don't want to hear about it. Since the pictures at Abu Ghraib, which riveted people's attention, since then there have been no more pictures. The government has carefully clamped down on illustrative material, which is much more powerful. And people have said, oh, don't tell us about it. We don't want to hear about it. Let's just leave us alone.
Within that stream, do you ever, Anthony Lewis, late at night, question yourself and say, am I wrong to raise these questions? Is the age of terrorism different? Is the threat to the nation such that I'm just raising the wrong alarm here? The conservatives say, look, much as you've said, we've done what's necessary. This hasn't been any kind of wholesale abuse of the American Constitution. We've got to protect this nation. Do you ever have those second thoughts?
Not all conservatives say that by any means.
Certainly not. That's not true.
By any means. Many of them are right on agreement with what I've said and others have said.
But you, any second thoughts?
No, never. And I'll tell you why. Not just because I think it's indecent for Americans to engage in such brutal tactics. Killing prisoners? Come on.
Beating legs to a pulp.
There was a story May 20th in the New York Times about two prisoners at Bagram Air Base in Afghanistan and how these soldiers just beat them up and left them hanging by their hands from the ceiling until they died. It just turned your stomach. It isn't just that it's indecent, but that it does such harm to the United States all over the Middle East now, and in fact all over the world. We are identified with these lawless, inhumane practices. Is that what we want the United States to stand for? Is that good for our foreign policy? Is that good for our influence in the world? Of course not. It's bad, and it's just a practical question on top of the humane or the moral question.
There's another framing of the national interest. David's calling from Greensboro, North Carolina. David, you're on the line with Anthony Lewis. What's on your mind?
Well, I was just listening to the program this evening, and the comparison between the Nixon administration and the present administration, the only real difference is the fact that with Watergate, you had people of principle. You had a judiciary, a judge with principle. You had legislators with principles. You had an attorney general with principle, even though he got fired. And right now you don't have that. It seems like everything is just an abuse of power, and there are no checks and balances. There's a certain arrogance when you talk about the Bush administration, and it reminds me of the Gang of Four during the Chinese Revolution. You know, Rumsfeld, Cheney, I can't remember the other guy's name.
Donald Rumsfeld's not going to be happy to be compared with Madame Mao here, David.
Well, I mean, but you ought to stop acting like a man. But, you know, it's just the fact that there are no people of principles. There's Congress has none, the judiciary has none, and the executive definitely doesn't have any.
David, we've got it, and we thank you for your call. Tony Lewis?
David, thank you very much for that interesting comment. I think you're unfair to the judges. I think you have a very important point. But the judges are beginning to question these unilateral assertions of executive power. Let me give you an example. We haven't talked about the domestic side, where President Bush has claimed the authority to put any American citizen in prison forever, without a trial, without access to a lawyer, on suspicion of being connected to terrorism. A year ago, the Supreme Court held that idea invalid. It stepped up to the plate and hit the ball. And
Senator Day O'Connor saying a state of war is not a blank check for the president when it comes to the rights of the nation's citizens.
Thank you. What a good quote.
They
stepped up to the ball. And again, in Guantanamo, they said, against the wishes of the Bush administration, the Supreme Court justices said, the prisoners on Guantanamo have the right to come into American courts and seek release on habeas corpus.
So has that cleaned up Guantanamo? Has that set everything right with the world?
No, because the Bush administration has done its best to avoid the impact of that ruling, and it's going right back up to the Supreme Court as we speak.
What do you expect to come out of that?
I think the court will stand fast and say, give them the hearings they're entitled to. Let them find out in detail what it is they're suspected of. They've had peculiar hearings in Guantanamo before tribunals of American military officers who don't tell them what the charges are. the charges are all in secret documents. They're not allowed to know. Well, what kind of a hearing is that? Which one of us would want to be convicted of a charge that we never knew? It's a bit Kafkaesque.
Do the court's rulings pull those prisoners back under the umbrella of the Geneva Convention or not?
Well, no, not the Supreme Court decision, but there has subsequently been an important trial court decision, one of the ones that's on its way back up to the Supreme Court, that did say these people should have been covered by the Geneva Convention. The administration's attempt to exclude them from the Geneva Convention was outside the law, so let's give them what they're entitled to under the Geneva Convention.
Well, I think conflicting judgments there, that not resolved yet.
Several judges took that view. One took another view, so they're on their way up to the Supreme Court.
Anthony Lewis, please stand by. Callers will turn to a lot more of you in just a moment. We're talking tonight with Pulitzer Prize-winning New York Times reporter and columnist Anthony Lewis for many years about the use and abuse of executive power in America. You can join the conversation. Has command responsibility for Abu Ghraib and its cousins been adequately investigated? And how high should an investigation go? We're at 1-800-423-8255. This is On Point. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight with longtime New York Times reporter and columnist Anthony Lewis about the use and abuse of executive power in America. From Watergate to Guantanamo, you can join us. What's your take on the state of civil liberties in the midst of the war on terror? What's your question, your comment for Anthony Lewis? And what's the trajectory of American executive power at the dawn of this new century? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Terry's calling from North Reading, Massachusetts. Hi, Terry. You're on the air.
Hi, how are you?
Very well, thanks.
Mr. Lewis, let me thank you for being such a testimony for the truth. You know, my original question, Tom, was kind of about how do you get criminals to police themselves?
Who are you talking about?
Well, I'm talking about the government.
Are you so sure they're criminals?
I agree with, well, the question is, are they criminals? And the only way you're going to discover that, I agree with Mr. Lewis, is if you have an independent prosecutor. The Nixon government would have never gone down at all if it weren't for Archibald Cox. And I was alive then. I'm 62.
Mm-hmm.
And I remember thinking that would it be possible, you know, to deal with the problem because it was so deep-seated. And I think when we have gotten into a situation here where we think that it's okay to kill prisoners, that it's okay to abuse them. And, you know, Amnesty International is a very, very, very honorable organization.
Donald Rumsfeld quoted them a lot in the run-up to war with Iraq, quoted their evidence, their research on Iraq as evidence for the need to go to war.
Yeah, and that we were, you know, that we needed to go there to help out the people in Iraq and so on. Yeah, now we don't like it. But, now we don't like what they're saying.
But let me ask you, I mean, we are at war in Iraq. There has been a terrorist attack on this country. There could well be more. Do you really want an independent prosecutor with subpoena power sticking that in the ribs of Donald Rumsfeld and George Bush when we are, the president says, at war, Terry?
Well, let me put it this way. I recently heard on NPR, actually, a member of the British Parliament saying that if we were going to lose our own liberties, then she didn't really think there was any point in going on with it. Because the whole point of it, you know, Tom, is we're going to lose our own liberties. If we're going to lose our liberties in order to make ourselves safe, how many people did Saddam Hussein kill during his reign? Less than we've killed now, I think.
I don't think so.
he killed a lot. He killed a lot, and I think certainly more. But the point, Terry, that you raised here, let me put it to Anthony Lewis, this is kind of singing your song, on the risk of losing American principles in the fight to defend the country. But how do you see that?
Well, the example that comes to my mind is Israel. Israel has faced terrorism during its entire existence since the day it was born in 1948.
Mm.
And it has, you know, continuous battle with terrorism. The Supreme Court of Israel, in a judgment a few years ago, held that despite the terrorist threat, and even in the face of a specific terrorist threat, government investigators and interrogators could not use torture. And in the language of the Chief Justice of that court, Aharon Barak, it is the burden of democratic societies that they have to behave better. That's both a burden and a strength.
But how far do you take that? Hypothetical. There's a nuclear, you know, bomb somewhere in an American city. Do you break the legs or not?
It's such a... I know it's not funny. I smiled because it's the one example that's always given, the ticking
bomb example.
The
ticking
bomb. The example was discussed by Chief Justice Barak of Israel. It very seldom happens. It's a very remote and theoretical example, and it's mostly a crutch for people who want to use torture for something much less significant.
Then let me put it in a more moderate way.
Yes,
okay. Are you confident, then, that... That abiding by American law very strictly, extending civil liberties to every citizen, extending international treaty coverage to every prisoner, does it open up some extra margin of vulnerability to the United States? Does it open the country to some extra margin of vulnerability? And are you saying, Anthony Lewis, you're willing to live with that in order to preserve civil liberties? Are you willing to pay with blood of vulnerability?
Oh,
forget the nuclear weapon. I'm saying something less.
I don't think we're paying. We would pay anything significant. And after all, you're just the premise of your question is that we can waive our commitments under treaties and under laws passed by Congress anytime we feel like.
But
it.
But that's the evidence
what kind of a
since 9/11. Well, it's the country we're in, isn't it, at the moment?
We're just going to dispose of laws we don't like and not observe them? Is that the way the government should behave? Let me pick up something you said earlier in your intro. You spoke of the trajectory of civil liberties. Of civil liberties and executive power, the trajectory. Mm. Well, one thing that's different and very significantly different from the present episode, the present circumstance, and past episodes like the removal of the Japanese Americans in World War II is that those were all time limited. And when the emergency was over, we generally apologized. We eventually apologized to the Japanese Americans and paid the survivors modest compensation. The same thing was true way back at the beginning of our constitutional history, the Sedition Act of 1798. We repaid the fines. But this time, it's an endless war. That's what's really frightening. Nobody can tell you when the war against terror is going to be over. I don't think it'll be over in my lifetime because there's always going to be a terrorist threat now. That's the reality we're living with. So we're going to sacrifice our system, our democratic principles, our civil liberties forever. I think that's a very serious proposition.
Are you concerned it could actually go that far? Tom Friedman at your old paper, The Times, writing in his column today that maybe something core has changed in American attitudes since 9/11. Maybe Americans, you said it yourself earlier, you don't see Americans, the American public, standing up stridently for those civil liberties. Is it possible that something has changed, that it's the security nation above civil liberties now that's at play?
I think it's natural for people to think first of their security, not just Americans, but everybody. And the trauma inflicted on us by 9/11 should never be underestimated. It was a terrible thing. Shocking. It made us feel vulnerable in a way that we'd never felt before. That's all true. But I tell you, in the long run, I'm an optimist about the American character. Maybe I'm a simple-minded fellow, but I really think Americans don't want to torture prisoners. I don't think they want to have them chained to the floor, lying in their own urine for 24 hours, having air conditioning turned up so far that they tear their hair out in frustration. I don't think Americans
heads
want
bound
that.
In duct tape and all the rest.
All that stuff, no.
Dennis is calling from Fitchburg, Massachusetts. Dennis, you're on the air.
Hi. Actually, I'm from Virginia, but I'm traveling to Massachusetts. And I'm actually a conservative. And
good to have you,
Dennis.
I
oppose this war, and I oppose what's going on. I think the mere fact that we call it a war, even though we haven't obeyed our own constitution, as Mr. Lewis says, we don't follow the rules. We just toss them out when it's inconvenient. But my question for Mr. Lewis is, would you please name some of the conservatives that you think are taking a stand and opposing this kind of thing?
One name comes immediately to mind. That's a commentator named Andrew Sullivan, who nowadays, he used to be editor of the New Republic. He had written a lot for the New York Times and various other things. But now he primarily writes in his own blog. It's a famous blog, the Andrew Sullivan blog.
Yep.
He's been very, very strong. I can even read you something that I happen to have with me. It is now indisputable that a network of secret prisons exists to detain and interrogate terror suspects, that some of those imprisoned are ghost detainees with no proper records or accounting, that abuse and torture have occurred in hundreds of cases, that the president signed a memo defining torture into near non-existent, that there is no secure method for determining the guilt or innocence of the prisoners, and that all of this has decimated America's international reputation. That's Andrew Sullivan. There are others, and I was trying to think of them earlier, but I can't at the moment.
I think Dennis would like to hear some names from the halls of power. When you look at the Senate, when you look at the House, when you look at the cabinet.
Lindsey Graham, the senator from South Carolina, has been very good on this issue. You'll remember him from the impeachment inquiry into President Clinton. He since has become a senator. He was a member of the House then. Mm-hmm. He's been very fair-minded and very good on this issue. That's one name that comes to mind. But the earlier caller who said we don't have any voices inside the administration is right. We don't have an Elliot Richardson, the attorney general who was fired for standing up for the law against President Nixon.
Watergate era. Mm-hmm.
And we don't have really a senator. You said you were from Virginia. I'm thinking of Senator Sam Ervin of North Carolina, mm-hmm. who did a wonderful job interrogating members of the administration in the Watergate example, and in fact was there interrogating them when Mr. Butterfield let loose the fact that they were tapes, and that finished the ball game.
If we can't put more names on that today, let me put it to you a different way. You emerged from your long career. I mean, you're still at it, but as a kind of famous liberal figure, is there a difference between the liberal case for civil liberties and the conservative case at bottom?
I don't think so. The strongest opinion in the Supreme Court in the case I mentioned earlier, the case about American citizens detained without trial and without access to his lawyer, came from Justice Scalia, the leading conservative, perhaps generally thought to be the leading conservative on the Supreme Court. I mean, I think these are conservative values. I don't see any difference. And I tell you, I think if it weren't a question of preserving your own administration, a lot of Republicans in Congress would be saying the same thing.
Alan's calling from Raleigh, North Carolina. Hi, Alan. You're on the air.
Hello. Thank you for taking my call. I'm a 12-year Navy veteran, served in the first Gulf War, and I just wanted to say real quickly that I can totally agree that this administration should be held fully accountable for whatever actions they committed or did not commit.
Well, accountable why and for what, Alan?
Beg your pardon?
Accountable why and for what?
Why? For the human rights. I mean, as a civilization, it's my opinion that we can't move forward until we fully recognize that every human being, regardless of their point of view, has human rights, and those human rights should be strictly adhered to. In all cases, regardless of whether they're carrying the atomic bomb and are walking in a mall in Raleigh, North Carolina.
Alan, you're a military veteran. Do you see a contradiction, a conflict between civil liberties, human rights, and national security?
No. I do not.
That's a pretty straightforward...
If I may say something.
Yes, Tony Lewis, please.
Alan, thank you. It's a pleasure to hear you because I think you represent what Americans... What I really believe Americans are like, rejecting torture and not wanting us to behave the way Saddam Hussein behaved. You know, it was wrong when someone said earlier that we had killed more people in Iraq than he did. I don't think that's right. Saddam Hussein brutally tortured and gassed thousands of people, and no good word should be said for him. But that's not our image. That's not what we want to do.
Ellen, thanks for your call. Let's get another call here. Julian is calling from South Boston, Virginia. Hi, Julian. You're on the air.
Hello there. Thank you very much. A little statement here. You know, in a private sector where our corporate leadership finds the most naive people in the world they can to exploit relentlessly and also compromise jobs and in this country, and where the ethics of war have completely changed in the face of the first preemptive strike in the history of our nation, much to our shame, I don't find much hope. You know, I remember when Martin Luther King stood up for things that were wrong in this country outside of the auspices of the government and organized people and then stood up against those policies which were so evil. I look forward to something like that happening now. Much ashamed of this current situation, both in the private and governmental sector.
Julian, what do you think would provoke more Americans to stand up and take these threats to civil liberties seriously?
Well, I think we need a charismatic leader. I think we need a real charismatic leader like your guest to get involved to the point where they're willing to take us to the streets. and where we can stand up and take, you know, have notice taken that we don't like the current unethical practices, both in the private and the governmental sectors. I'm sick and tired of it.
Julian, our time is short, but we thank you for your call, Tony Lewis. Are you going to be standing up in front of the Lincoln Memorial there, Tony?
I like your comparison with Dr. King. I like your mentioning Dr. King because he had this unique ability to bring moral considerations, moral strength to political questions, and people responded. And I agree with you. We need somebody who can do that, some political figure.
Let's get one more call. Seamus is calling from Boston. Hi, Seamus, you're on the air.
Hello, Ms. Anthony. My name is Seamus. I was a guest speaker with you in 2003 with American Repertoire Theater in a play before a play called Children of Heraclius. I don't know if you remember. I just want to say hello.
Hello.
We're here, Seamus. Take us to your comment, your question.
I just want to... I have two comments. One comment is George W. Bush is calling Amnesty International's allegations absurd. The absurd thing is that this administration is sending the prisoners outside to the countries that are known for torture, for practicing tortures. This is observed.
Seamus, we've got it, and our time is short. I appreciate your call. Tony Lewis, step way back here. What do you think is going to determine this, the onward trajectory here of executive power, use, abuse, where we go with civil liberties? What's the determinant of where we drift, ahead, steer?
Well, I have to give you an answer that I don't think is very philosophical and probably will disappoint you. I think much will depend on the course of two wars, the war against terror and the war in Iraq. I think if there's another terrorist strike on this country, I think people would react the wrong way. They would be even more frightened and would be ready to condone violations of civil liberties and excesses in the name of fighting terror. I'm just... You know, I feel apprehensive about that. It's always possible. Mm. And I think if the war in Iraq continues to go badly as it's going now, and, you know, just 2 days ago, our forces arrested a leading Sunni politician, people we're trying to
bring into the fold
and make happier with us, and mistreated his guards with dogs so that they had bite marks on their faces. You know, behavior like that isn't going to do us any good. But if it goes badly, the reaction inside this country could be bad.
Tony Lewis, it's wonderful to have you. You don't exactly bring us comfort, but you bring us a passion and insight that we're hungry for and we appreciate. Thank you so much for being with us tonight. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. On Point is produced by Meghna Chakrabarty, Rachel Dornhelm, Julie Jopp, Eileen Amata, John Roberts, James Ross, and Karen Schiffman, with help from Pam Ferdinand, Michael Garth, Jim Moses, Marika Bukas, Tim Skog, and Angel Cazelli. Our senior producer is Graham Griffith. Tony Lewis with us tonight. This is On Point.
On Point is a production of WBUR Boston and NPR, National Public Radio.